This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with writer and filmmaker Tariq Ali.
One of the most lucid political thinkers of our time. Pay close attention to this interview. We hear Jim Lafferty's acceptance speech at the 75th anniversary convention of the National Lawyers Guild in Pasadena last month.
The Guild was founded in 37. Its motto is people over property.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, the European Court on Human Rights has just issued an important decision on El Masri. Tell us about it.
It's an absolutely amazing, remarkable decision. It's really the first court with international standing like that to ever find the United States in violation of the Convention Against Torture over its treatment of El Masri. El Masri is a German national. He was on his way for a vacation, I think in Macedonia or somewhere. He's picked up in Macedonia, arrested in Macedonia, taken by the CIA, and treated very badly. When he was picked up in Macedonia on January 23rd, 2004, this was by the CIA, he was handcuffed, blindfolded, driven to the airport. He was placed in a room where he was beaten by several disguised men dressed in black, stripped and sodomized with an object. That's the suppository they put in him to put him to sleep, I guess. He was placed in a nappy and dressed in a dark blue short-sleeve tracksuit. Shackled and hooded and subjected to total sensory deprivation, he was forcibly marched to the CIA aircraft, which was surrounded by Macedonian security guards. When on the plane, he was thrown to the floor, chained down, and forcibly tranquilized. He was then flown to Kabul in Afghanistan, where he was essentially questioned, etc., and eventually freed because they had the wrong guy. They knew for months that they had the wrong guy, but they kept him in the prison, kept him in this position. But the key part of this for the United States was the rendition procedures followed in El Masri's case are the same that were followed in scores, if not hundreds of renditions that the United States was involved in. They would pick up a guy somewhere in the world, cut his clothes off with knives, put a suppository in him, blindfold him, hood him, shackle him, the whole thing, beat him on occasion, and it's exactly what happened. Now, the European Court of Human Rights doesn't have jurisdiction over the United States, but they do have jurisdiction over Macedonia, and Macedonia was found guilty of part of this conspiracy to involve itself with the rendition and torture of El Masri. But in passing on that, they condemned the United States the first time for violating the Convention Against Torture. And what's interesting about the case, a lot that's interesting, that alone is pretty interesting, but that it's important to understand that although El Masri was not guilty of anything, picked up by mistake, they've never given El Masri any compensation, never given him any assistance with medical care, never offered official acknowledgement of his mistreatment to El Masri, nor any apology at all. They simply offered an apology to Chancellor Merkel of Germany. And that what's amazing about this, the person principally responsible for El Masri's mistreatment, a woman agent, Alfreda Frances Bukowski, was reclassified after this all came out as a covert operative because the Washington Post was about to disclose her identity and they wanted it not disclosed, so they reclassified her as a covert operative. It was disclosed anyway. Now, Bukowski was singled out, interestingly, for praise and advancement of head of her contemporaries, and she was advanced to the head of the Al-Qaeda unit at Langley, where she was in a position and still is in a position to advocate lethal force and violence. So she's been given a lot for this completely false arrest and this violation of the Convention Against Torture. But luckily, although luckily, she cannot travel to nations within the European zone because she's afraid of being arrested over this involvement in the assault and torture and drugging of a German national, El Masri.
You know, the victim of this sort of rendition brought a lawsuit that hit the federal courts a couple of years ago when Obama was president. The airline that serve to render this poor person was a CIA affiliate. So the airline was sued. And the judge sitting there in a federal court says to the government representing the Obama administration, what's your position? The U.S. attorney said, well, it's a state secret. We can't tell you anything about this, and we want the case dismissed. So the judge scratched his head. What are you telling me? He said, Obama was just elected. Haven't you changed your position since Bush? The U.S. attorney said no. So they wouldn't supply any information. They said it was a state secret, and the person that was rendered got no satisfaction whatsoever. So it's good to see that if you can't get justice in a United States court, at least you can go to Europe.
There's been no case in the United States that has ever gone forward to compensation, but ever gone to trial on any of these many, many torture abuse cases. In Europe, it went against Macedonia. Macedonia actually has to give money to al-Masri. The United States, of course, but unfortunately, the court has no authority with regard to the United States. But it is an incredible condemnation of the United States.
This is foreshadowing a show we're going to have in the near future, Michael, on that Hollywood movie that excuses torture. What's the name of the movie? Zero Dark Thirty, a very slick Hollywood-made movie by the woman director who did The Hurt Locker. This movie puts forward the proposition that torture works. It's a pragmatic justification of torture. The truth of the matter is, I mean, apart from the inhumanity thing, which makes us against torture per se, torture doesn't work. But an aspect of this whole huge propaganda machine is being displayed with this slick Hollywood movie. And I think, Michael, that kind of propaganda has been very effective in this country, and that the majority of Americans probably believe that torture works, and that's why there hasn't been any justice rendered to the illegal actors here who have done these things in the last 10 years.
Well, it's interesting. Zero Dark Thirty does show apparently very brutal scenes of torture, including waterboarding.
Yeah.
And it does have the false premise in it that the waterboarding led somehow to the courier who somehow then led to the hideout of Osama bin Laden. And that's false. Even Dianne Feinstein on the Senate Intelligence Committee as a senator has said it had nothing to do with torture or that getting Osama bin Laden. So it has a false premise in there. When the filmmakers were pushed on that issue, they said, well, look, it's a movie, except for the fact that this movie has done more already to legitimize torture than everything Karl Rove ever did in his life.
And didn't they work with the CIA in making this movie? And didn't the CIA give them documentation and consult with them?
You know, Michael, I don't know, but we'll get to that when we discuss it more. But there is now some investigation of a CIA agent or some federal official for giving classified information to the filmmakers. Now, the filmmaker Bigelow, as you said, did Hurt Locker, which I thought was a pro-war movie. I had friends who disagreed with me, but I thought it was a complete pro-war movie. So the question is, what do you expect out of Bigelow? But this film apparently is incredibly well done.
That's a problem.
It's a problem. It's mass media justifying torture. So we have some country, huh?
Today we're joined by internationally renowned writer and activist Tariq Ali. A writer and filmmaker, Tariq has written more than 24 books on world history and politics, including The Duel, Pakistan on the Flight Path of American Power, The Obama Syndrome, and On History. We talk specifically about several turning points in global history, including the Occupy movement and the U.S. elections. We are delighted to offer an extended an exclusive interview today. Tariq Ali, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Very glad to be with you.
Tariq, I was a student, a history student at the University of Wisconsin in the 60s, which was a happening place then and now. And we had a wonderful social history teacher named Harvey Goldberg. And he was a Marxist, and he would talk about why study history. And he said, it's not for the whatever detail here or there. We study history because we want to identify what's usable in the past. And I have to say that your two books, The Obama Syndrome and then your new book On History, is just a brilliant example of what Goldberg was trying to teach us. So with that in mind, let me ask you, going back to the First World War and the beginning of the United States getting on the stage of world history, talk about how America wound up as the imperial power that it is today.
I think the First World War was pretty crucial, but it was not just the war itself. It was the consequences of that war a few years into it, that here you had huge empires, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the British Empire, the wannabe German Empire. All of them wanted a share of the world, and they forgot what was taking place below the surface in their own countries. You had huge working class movements, organized or clandestine, depending where they were. And suddenly, a medium-sized, bald man stood up in Petrograd, and when he was asked mockingly, is there anyone here who wants to actually take power? This bald man, whose name was Lenin, said, yes, I do, and the Bolshevik Party does. And people roared with laughter, thinking, these punks are going to take power? And they did. And that was the only time in history of a planned and orchestrated attempt to take power and make a revolution that would break with capitalism. All the previous revolutions had not broken. They were accidental in a way. The bourgeois revolutions in France and in England. This was a planned, carefully thought out revolution. And that revolution, which challenged capitalism frontally and said, it whose leaders said, we want Europe to be with us, on our own we can't do it. We need the Germans. We need a German revolution. That frightened the capitalist class globally. And that was, in my opinion, a decisive event for the United States. That Lenin wrote his April thesis saying why the Bolsheviks must take power. And virtually at the same time, Woodrow Wilson, with his lofty rhetoric, very reminiscent of Obama in many ways, actually decided that the time had come to intervene. So the intervention of the United States on the world stage was a result and linked to the revolutionary movements that were developing in Europe. And they felt that the other powers couldn't do it, and they had to do something.
The United States actually sent troops to Russia to try to overturn the anti-capitalist revolution.
22 countries did. It was not just the United States. The Brits did, the French did, the Czechs did, the Hungarians did. I mean, there were 22 foreign armies of intervention trying to defeat this revolution. And that war cost them dearly, because the First World War had already bled the nation dry. This war of intervention and the civil war that followed made it impossible for the early infant Soviet Union to achieve what it wanted to achieve.
Well, you say in your book on history, the dialogue that you have with Oliver Stone, that you mark really the end of the Soviet Union as the entity that the leaders of it hoped it would be in around 1929, and I would agree for the reasons you just said. But then take us up to the Second World War, which you see as kind of an extension of the First World War.
Well, the Second World War was once again now an effort by the German ruling class to get its share of the world market in countries. Not in commodities, in countries. And we get very obsessed with the Germans for being fascists, and rightly so, obviously. But they were not just that. The reason they were popular was that Hitler used to stand up. He didn't always go on about the Jews. In fact, if you look at his speeches, they were discussing the future of Germany. And he would stand in front of a map and say, let's take three European countries. This is Britain. This is France. Look how much of the world they own. This is Germany. We're bigger than them. Why can't we have our share? And so the German Nazi thrust to domination was provoked by the refusal of the French and the Brits to actually share the world with them. That is what provoked, in my opinion, the German decision to carry out preemptive strikes and try and take Europe. So it was at the very beginning, a war for empire, a war to make Germany a strong imperialist country on a global scale. And had they succeeded, and they might have succeeded, the United States would have dealt with them as with another power. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
But they didn't succeed. The United States rose as really a preeminent power after the Second World War. And it did something, as you point out in your book on history, that has never been done before. It rebuilt the vanquished countries in Europe. And tell us what you think the result of that was.
Well, let's first discuss why they did it. And the reason why they did it is because they perceived a larger enemy, and that enemy was the Soviet Union. And they said that communism is the enemy of capitalism, and in order to defeat it, we have to keep capitalism united. We can't fight each other again. That must not be allowed to happen. So they rebuilt the defeated capitalist countries. Obviously, principally, Japan and Germany were built as economic miracles. And then they helped to build France and Britain via the Marshall Plan. And that has never been done by a big imperial power before, building countries that were its economic and political rivals for hundreds of years. And that was, you know, from the point of view of America's imperial elite, that was a far-sighted move. And it worked. Ultimately, they managed to get the Soviet Union to implode by having an arms race, which was so out of control, and the Russians fell into their trap and decided to go for the arms race. Had they not, history might have been different. And they're now trying to do the same with China, and I hope the Chinese do not fall into the same trap again, threatened by Obama's puny little bases in Australia. But anyway, that is what happened in the Second World War, and that was determined, I think, by the not just the existence of the Soviet Union, but the prestige. We forget now that had it not been for the great victories of the Soviet Red Army at Kursk and Stalingrad, Europe might not have managed to withstand the Nazis. I mean, that's just a fact. Kursk was the largest tank battle of the Second World War. And the defeat of the German army at Stalingrad, essentially, together with the Kursk, broke the spinal cord of the Third Reich. Now when you see Hollywood movies, Saving Private Ryan and Saving So-and-so, I mean, the Russians are just written out of that history. And yet without them and their struggle and their fight, I doubt that the United States allies in Europe would have won that war.
Let's talk about how the anti-communism of the American elites was reflected here in the United States with respect to their politics, the Palmer raids up to the Taft-Hartley Act and so on. Is that, in your understanding, a reason why the American left-wing movement is so weak today?
I think that is one reason that the repression in the United States in the early years of the rise of American capitalism was sustained and brutal. And it's not just the raids, Palmer raids, or even the raids on Italian migrants during the Woodrow Wilson period, which was horrific. It's not simply that. I think that there was a material basis to it, that people in the United States, the early settlers, got land totally free. And they took it, and that created in the American psyche this belief in private property, that we got the land, but you didn't get it, you stole it. And in order to make that land yours and not pay for it, you had to wipe out the native population to a very large extent. It isn't that this was a country that wasn't populated. It may have been thinly populated, but the indigenous tribes played an important part in that country before the settlers moved in. But this mythology of the sort of frontier peoples, and then, you know, even at an early stage, the quarrels with Mexico, the stealing of land from Mexico, building the West, what is now the West Coast states of the United States, was done through war. So even before they got active in Europe and on a global stage, they had already been practicing regionally this internal expansion. based on war against neighboring countries, Mexico in this case, and exterminating native peoples was pretty important in the psyche of the United States. And so by the time you had the development of a working class, this was already well established, that there was something unique and special about being American. And no one thought too hard about what the speciality was. But now the whole world knows it was killing and murder.
A sense of entitlement.
A sense that we are the ones. We are the ones, you know, the Protestants who settled here. It was very strong, the divine providence, God, you know, the city on the hill. We are fated. It's predestination, which the Catholics who occupied South America never had. And fewer people were killed as brutally in the South than they were in the North. And I think this has a great deal to do with Protestant fundamentalism.
Coming forward now to the final collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern European states and the kind of triumphalism that you had here in the United States, it doesn't exist anymore, really, does it? Because now they got involved in Iraq and then in Afghanistan. What's your take on the direction of the American empire today?
Well, I think it's important to point out and stress this, that the defeat of the Soviet Union, the implosion of those countries. Two points need to be made about it. The first, that even though it's very fashionable now amongst right-wing historians to compare the Soviet Union to Nazi Germany, Nazi Germany they could not have defeated, and the Third Reich without a vicious, brutal war. The Soviet Union imploded. They did not have to defeat it because its own people lost faith in the system, essentially. And they had an incredibly stupid, foolish, and arrogant bureaucracy who felt that they were there forever. And the links between the people and the bureaucrats running the country failed. So no one had to force them. It happened of its own accord, of course, aided by the arms drive. But nonetheless, the implosion of that system did create throughout the world a feeling that there had been a huge defeat, and that was not totally wrong. Regardless of what that system was, with all its flaws, people saw it as something which might in years to come rebuild itself into something more positive, a better model for socialism. But that never happened. And so the triumph was complete. And the fact that there is no alternative coming up to the current sets of crises afflicting capitalism is related largely to the collapse of the 1990s. Because it's astonishing when you look at it. The Wall Street system crashes in 2008. The crash has, it's seismic. It's like an earthquake. It goes underneath the Atlantic. It affects Europe. European countries tremble, on the verge of collapse. Democracy is threatened. Parliaments in Europe are voting to have non-elected, unrepresentative bankers running Italy and Greece. So there's a huge crisis. But nothing is emerging from below that offers an alternative, saying this is what we want. And because of that, you haven't had what you should have had, in my opinion, which is cities in Greece and possibly Spain, but certainly Italy, falling. The masses taking over the cities. It didn't happen in the Arab world either. No cities taken, no popular assemblies to say, it's our city and we're going to show you how to run it, which would then have spread. And the reason is that people still haven't recovered and feel that there is really no alternative. That's a problem where you've had huge mass movements, and that problem is also reflected in the occupation movements in the United States. It's protest, it attacks the system, it has nothing to offer.
Before we talk about the Occupy movements, turning to the Obama administration, can you offer thoughts about why he has not created New Deal-type legislation to build up our own infrastructure?
Because the entire elite in the United States and Western Europe was wedded to the Washington Consensus that emerged after the collapse of communism. And the centerpiece of this consensus was a system which believed in market forces. I've referred to it as market fundamentalism, that the market will solve all our problems, that we don't need the state to do anything, which was a sleight of hand because they needed the state to impose these conditions in which the market could rule. Without the state, they couldn't have done it. And saying the state can't help the poor any longer, the state shouldn't be in charge of education, of health, all these things became quite common in the world. And then when the market couldn't handle it, and had it been left alone, the system would have virtually collapsed, then all these people who have been attacking people like me for years went on their knees and said to the state, "State, dear state, please help us, because without your help, we're finished." And the dear state, run by the elites, linked to these corporations, came and gave them billions and billions of dollars to bail out the rich. That's what they did. So bailing out the poor is impermissible. Bailing out the rich is what these people do. And so we have a rule which I have described in more recent work in the capitalist world, which I call the extreme center. This center, which includes the Democrats and centrist Republicans, or Labour and Conservative, or Social Democrats and Christian Democrats, or Sarkozy Conservatives and Social, they are all part of this extreme center with differences on nuance, not anything more. They believe in fighting wars. They believe in invading countries. They occupy brutally. They defend killing in the name of human rights. They punish their own people. They defend austerity measures which keep the profits of the rich going. So this is the extremism that we're confronting. It's the extremism of the center. And the result of this is that no alternatives exist. Within mainstream politics, in my opinion, there are no alternatives at the moment. And the effect that this is having is hollowing out democracy itself.
Were you surprised that the Occupy movement has sustained itself as long as it has?
No, because it's a movement that, you know, is incredibly decent, that has good instincts in terms of what it's attacking. But the occupations themselves, I mean, the movement is still there. The occupations have ceased to exist. I mean, I spoke at the occupation in Oakland, you know, argued in favor of putting some demands forward, a charter of demands. I think that's what we need, is for these movements to call an assembly off nationally and discuss a charter of demands for a progressive America, which need only be 10 demands, but something around which people can rally. Otherwise, all this effort will go to waste.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well, of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is shower. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. and the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear, and the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized, and my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken to the cry, come on.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with writer and activist Tariq Ali.
Well, the Russian revolutionaries said we want bread, peace, and land. It was very simple and very radical.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, the demands that should be raised here are similar. I mean, peace, of course, is a central demand. And it is ironic that the only candidate in these shenanigans that are taking place who demands the dismantling of the empire is Ron Paul, which is why he's popular in different parts of the world which suffer from the empire. People tell me, Pakistan, South America, who is this Ron Paul guy? Do you know him? I said, no, he's not really on our side, but I know he sometimes says good things. You have to say that to people. No Democrat would dare say that. No other Republican says that. It's demands like this. I mean, the demand for peace has to be raised, the demand for free health, the demand for a free education system, the demand that no company, corporation, or individual should make profit from the basic needs of human beings, which is what is happening. These demands are comprehensible to people. They're not that, you know, they're not sort of complex. Everyone can understand them. Do you think someone should make a profit because you're suffering from cancer? Or because, you need some medical attention? Why should your health be used to make profit for the pharmaceuticals? And I argued yesterday at the New York Public Library in a talk I did with Oliver Stone that people who attack the state should note that those states, Cuba is one example, who produce their own medicines, produce medicine that is really cheap. And if American citizens had access, were there no sanctions against Cuba and Cuban medicines were freely available, the pharmaceuticals here would collapse. They would never let it happen because it shows that the state, which doesn't want to make profits out of people's health, can produce medicines very cheap which are available to all.
We're speaking with Tariq Ali, who has recently written the book On History with Oliver Stone, and not so recently, but not that long ago, wrote an excellent book that people should also read called The Obama Syndrome, which has been updated. Tariq, tell me, what was it that radicalized you politically? How did you become a Marxist?
Well, I came from a wealthy family. But my parents had already broken from that family. They were both active in the struggle against British imperialism in India. My father became a communist when he was in his late teens, and later on my mother. So they were very active. So I grew up in a household which had a sort of two sides to it. One was the family. Most of it was deeply reactionary, a rich landed family. Lived off the land for centuries, traced its descent back from the 12th century, I don't know what. And they would come and visit, and, you know, one would be polite and sort of say nice things to them and hear nice things from them, but most of them were empty-headed. And then the other part of our house was poets, writers, bohemians, trade union leaders, peasant leaders, people who'd gone underground trying to hide from the government because they were on the wanted list. And this was the people I totally identified with. They were more interesting. They were alive. They talked about things which meant something, not just about what are we going to have for the next meal, or, you know, the servant problem is going out of control and all this nonsense. So that had a huge impact on me. I remember I was once playing cricket, which is a local sport that the British Empire implanted into India, and I had a team of young street urchins who I trained up, and one day one of them said to me, but you know, it's not fair that you can wear whites and we can't. And I said, no, you're absolutely right. So I went up to my cupboard and emptied it and gave them all white trousers and shirts to wear. You know, this is when I was about 10 or 11. My mother never forgot this, because when she came home from wherever she was in, she said, where have all your clothes gone? I said, distributed, free of charge, gratis. So, and they, my parents were very supportive. So I had no big conflict with them. That helped to shape me. And so when I left Pakistan and came to Oxford to study, I met many, many more like-minded people. And so I sort of read a lot more. I read books which weren't available in Pakistan, and really always been on the left ever since. I mean, sometimes, you know, people say to me, but aren't you tempted? I said, by what? To become a squalid third-rate politician making money, because that's all they're interested in. What is there to be tempted by? I'm not tempted. And then, you know, they say, but X or Y or who were like you in the 60s, they've gone to the right. I said, so what? I mean, that's not my problem. Sometimes people are surprised by that, but I'm not. I mean, I wouldn't be able to live with myself if I supported wars and, you know, became obsessed with making money on the stock market or something like that.
What do you think is most useful about the Marxist understanding of, say, history and economics?
Well, I think, you know, many people who are not on the left now are reading Marx. It's quite astonishing, because in order to understand the laws of motion of capital, you have to read this guy. He did it better than most, and no one's outpaced him yet. It's true, of course, that capitalism has become much, much more complex. Marx could never have visualized that the pressing of a computer button could transfer millions or billions of dollars from one country to the other, or how the stock market was affected by technology. He didn't, but he certainly foresaw the current crisis, you know, where he spoke about zombie capitalism and fictitious capitalism, where money is used to make more money, nothing happens. It's not money which is creating productive goods. It's money which is creating more money. He wrote about that a lot. He really did understand the system. And there are passages in the volumes of Capital which are pure literature. There are some which are very complicated and which put people off, but they should persevere and read it. And in terms of understanding history, he said that there are many determinations, but in reality, history is made in a process of struggle when social classes or their predecessors fight with each other. And he takes you back a long way to the ancient world, where he discusses some of these issues and things, and he and others. So for me, that has always been a very important and creative way of looking at the development of history. I mean, if you say, you know, history is a sort of old biscuit tin, that's history too. Well, I suppose it is in a way, but for me, the history of a biscuit tin would be, where did the tin come from? Who made it into a tin? What was the labor needed to extract it from the land? Etc., etc. So I think that remains a useful way to mark history. And not to say that history is a no-no, or history is a process without a narrative. History doesn't automatically progress or move upwards. It goes up and down. But there is a narrative. And I often say to the postmodernists, I said, you know, what's the narrative of history now? It is the domination of the world by capital. That is the single most important narrative driving history. The domination of most of the world by turbocharged capitalism. That is making history. And there have been no revolutions as yet, but there will be.
How did you come to collaborate with Oliver Stone?
I had written a book on South America because I got very engaged with the Venezuelan Bolivarian struggle and got to know Chavez very well. And angered by the coverage in the Western media of these events, I wrote a book called Pirates of the Caribbean, and the pirates were Chavez, Fidel Castro, Evo Morales, Rafael Correa, and the book was translated all over, and Oliver was traveling in South America and he read the book, so he tells me, and then he rang me up and said, "Hi, I'm Oliver Stone, you may know some of my work." I said, "Yeah, I know some of your work." And he said, "I'm working on this documentary on South America, south of the border. It'd be very good to catch up with you. And I'm also working on a 10-part series, The Untold History of the United States. So the next time you're in the States, let me know and we'll fly you to L.A. So I'd let him know, and he flew me to L.A. from, I think I was in Canada, in Montreal. And sat me down for 7 hours, or virtually a whole day, 8 hours, and interviewed me on film for that series, just to get my ideas. And the book is edited version of that long interview, which Oliver did. So we became friends.
We're talking about the book On History.
The book is on history, yeah.
It's pretty clear that Kennedy wasn't assassinated by Oswald, that there was a conspiracy, which by definition is more than one person, that was involved in Kennedy's assassination. And I wanted to tell you something you may not know and ask you to comment on it. There was a panel discussion at the University of California at Bolt Hall, which is their law school, 3 months ago. The dean of Bolt Hall is a man named Christopher Exley. Exley had been a Harvard law professor, and when Obama was elected, Exley was one of the top leaders of the transition team. So at this panel discussion at Bolt Hall, Exley was asked the following question. Did your transition team discuss the possibility of prosecuting the people in the Bush administration that were responsible for torture? And Exley said, "Yes, we did have that discussion. And we decided to recommend against it." And the reason we recommended against it was that we thought there were powerful elements in the CIA and the military in the United States that would, and this is his word, not mine, that would institute a coup. And when I read that, I thought, this is the same sort of thing that John Kennedy was up against, and you write about it in your book on history, when he was reconsidering the direction of the Cold War and wanting to reverse it, and then was assassinated. And I wanted your thoughts on that.
Well, I'm very interested in this. I didn't know that Exley had said that. It's very revealing. Of course, in this public talk, Oliver Stone and I discussed this, and I asked him where he had got his information for JFK, which indicated that Kennedy was about to shift. And he said, "I've not named him before, but he named a guy who was a colonel in the CIA or military intelligence. I can't remember. You will get it. It'll be on YouTube, this talk." Then he named him. He said, "He black ops operator," and he told me he had absolutely no doubt that Alan Dulles had ordered the execution of Kennedy. I mean, the audience, there was a sort of, you know, hush almost when Oliver said this, because he'd never named him before. Yeah. And he said, "So I really was getting it, this information, from people who were in the know. Obviously, this is the way they do it." And he said that, you know, if you get used to killing foreign heads of state, Lumumba, knocking out governments, imposing military coups in the rest of the world, what's to stop you doing it in your own country if that need arises? And he said that with Kennedy, they felt that that need arose. So this was just said yesterday in New York. I'm reporting it straight to you. So I'm not surprised, but I mean, the thing is that there was totally irrational fear of communism created by the Cold War, which was wrong, but it was there. Whereas today, there's no Cold War. There is not a single state which the United States you know, should regard as a rogue state, because they ain't any. I mean, they're most of these countries which are regarded as rogue states, North Korea, Iran, are just scared of being invaded by the United States. That's their problem. So the Cold War is over. So in this day and age, not to try people for torture when you're trying other heads of states in the world is unacceptable. And I wonder whether whether that was the real reason, or he knew that that was a reason which would go down well, you know, saying these people would have done anything. But all I will say is that these are different times where they've made human rights such a central plank of their drive towards war and global domination, that not to have some accountability in the United States, it's pretty appalling, really, because it makes it a mockery. The whole thing's a joke.
It makes the democracy a charade.
Yeah.
And creating so-called war on terrorism, perpetual wars that go on indefinitely.
Well, not just that, but, you know, Obama has gone beyond any other president, as far as I can see, in saying that it is now possible for the executive to instruct his security forces to target and take out an American citizen without due process of law. And when you think that the people who killed Lincoln, well, actually, it was defective. Obviously, the court-martial, you know, the United States was at war, but a trial did take place and evidence was presented. Whereas now, no need for a trial, no need for evidence, you can just take them out. And that's deeply shocking. And the fact that it's gone through without the political elite, the extreme center protesting at all, is an indication of how bad things are.
Your phrase, I think, is so apt, the hollowing out of democracy. That's what our show has been trying to chronicle over the last 8 years. With that in mind, had you been an American citizen, you would not have been a supporter of Obama then or now. And I'd like you to give me your thoughts on that and what you advise people, say, in the Occupy Wall Street movement. What should they do? Because Obama is going to be presented as a better alternative to Newt Gingrich or Mitt Romney. And in some ways, I suppose that's true. But what would you advise people to do?
Well, look, I think there are times when you have to make tactical decisions to vote for candidates who may not be everything you want them to be in order to defeat a president who is making war and making life miserable, both for his own citizens and the world at large. Sometimes you have to make those choices. I mean, I was here during the campaign for Obama, and I have to be honest, it gave me a great deal of joy to see how many young people had become engaged in politics. And that, I thought, was a huge, huge leap forward. And I observed them. I didn't say to them, you're going to be betrayed, because it's awful when someone with white hair comes and says to kids who are really active and eager, saying, you know, this guy's going to really stab you in the front. I knew it would happen, but I bit my lip. I didn't say it, and it has happened, and they've learned their own lesson. It's always better when people learn through their own experiences. But as to what should be done and what is to be done now, in my opinion, a movement needs to be created in the United States, state by state, in which some preparation is made to have an alternative social and political force in this country to the existing political parties. There is no getting away from it. It sounds dull, it sounds boring, but I think it's absolutely necessary. And I'm not saying that this should be created like a Bolshevik party or anything like that. I think it's a movement which should be created bearing what the needs of ordinary people are in present-day America. It can be very broad, it can have very loose discipline, but it has to be political. You cannot run away from politics. And people who run away from politics either end up being demoralized or integrated in some shape or form in the system. So my advice would be that the very least a charter of demands, of what the basic demands which large numbers of people will agree on, which create and enhance the consciousness which already exists. That's what we need today.
thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We're bringing you a special show on the 75th anniversary of the Lawyers Guild. The 75th anniversary convention was held 2 weeks ago in Pasadena, California. We have the winner of the Law for the People Award, Jim Lafferty, who's currently the organizer of the Lawyers Guild in Southern California.
As you know, Jim has been a member of the National Lawyers Guild for over 40 years.
Yeah, close to 50. I think he joined in 63. They hired him right out of law school to go down south because the Lawyers Guild was down there giving legal support to the registration of voters down south, that tremendously heroic movement where people defied the segregationists and registered to vote back in 1963. And Jim was down there. He's been active since then, 49 years. And I should say that Jim Lafferty was my partner along with five other people in a law collective in Detroit in the 60s. We did draft law and we did military law. Jim was one of the leaders of the anti-war movement at the time. He's been active on the political left with movement groups ever since. But we get to hear what lessons he's drawn from that almost half a century of political activism.
Well, you know, I didn't, like the rest of us, I didn't join the guild to get a discount on my car rentals. It's what you just saw from those four people and so many like them in this room, and the opportunity to be comrades and friends with those folks. That's why I joined the guild. I may not have known it at the time, but that's what I've come to learn. And I'm so grateful for this award, but frankly, I'm all the more grateful and much more grateful for the comradeship and the friendship we're all a part of, and that you've all been a part of that with me for so many years. Many of my friends are here tonight, and they came in some cases from quite some distance, and I so appreciate you being here with me. It means so much to me. Bonnie is sitting there, the love of my life. I love her more than the day we got married, and I suspect it's because she has tolerated all of my mishigas for 40 years, and that's one of her more lovable qualities. The Lawyers Guild is, I don't think we've, I somehow feel we haven't fully appreciated yet or acknowledged the fact that the Guild is 75 years old, and during all of those 75 years, and at some points, particularly during those 75 years, the government of this country tried its damnedest to shut this organization down. And it didn't matter what they threw at us. They tried to put us on the un-American list. They spied on us, and so we sued their ass, and we won. There is nothing, there is nothing, there is simply nothing that can stand in the way of the National Lawyers Guild, and if they haven't learned it by now, they're dumber than I think. As somebody was kind enough to point out, I'm only 1 year younger than the National Lawyers Guild is. And it's a very different world today than it was in 1937 when the Guild was founded, or in 1938 when I was founded. But seriously, and I'm not going to give you my whole life story, I had an hour or two here, and I had some pictures of my first steps and my daughter's first steps, but later in the other room, I'll show those for those who are still here. I was in those days, referred to as the bastard son of a very poor immigrant, single immigrant mother in Detroit. For whatever reason, I was always a dreamer. And I can remember in grade school, I was constantly being criticized by my teachers. Jimmy, where are you? You're on dreamland. You're always dreaming. You're not paying attention. And there was probably some truth to that. And I wasn't quite sure what I was dreaming about, but I was dreaming. But you know, it's important to remember that in those days, you could be poor, and I could get it, and I did, a great public education in Detroit. And I could go to college if you worked hard and go to law school. And I got out, I didn't owe a dime to anybody, the way all you poor folks, law students, do now. They get out and all owe all this money. It was a different world. And it was a consequence of that that I got to meet first Ernie Goodman and George Crockett, who you've heard already about tonight, two of the founding members of the National Lawyers Guild, two of the greatest lawyers this country has ever seen. And I count myself as lucky every day that happened to me, because it gave me the privilege, as I said earlier, of working for all of these years now with some of the great lawyers and legal workers and political organizers of this country and, frankly, of this world. Ernie hired me right out of law school, which is one reason why I have so much confidence in law students today. The law students today, I can tell you, know a hell of a lot more than I did when I got out of law school. I'm not being modest. I mean, that's just a fact. And you're a lot more politically sophisticated today than I was. But Ernie hired me right out of law school and gave me the chance right off the bat. That was our work in the South, that historic work. We don't pay enough attention talking about it. We changed the whole world at that time, or the whole country at that time. We established whole new laws. We were a boost to the civil rights movement that they needed when they needed it. And that, too, has been the history of the Guild. And it gave me the opportunity to meet people who then all along the way have inspired me. In the South, I met Mary Robinson. Who was Mary Robinson? Amazing woman. On her 70th birthday, she lived in Hattiesburg. She sees a demonstration going on. She joins it. It's for voters' rights. They arrest her. They throw her in jail. They take her one winter coat. When she gets out of jail and gets back to her one-room house in the woods outside of Hattiesburg, dog is dead. They've killed the dog. Cross burning still on her front lawn, still smoldering. And I said, Mary, what possessed you at age 70 to finally join a demonstration, knowing damn well what was going to happen? She said, Mr. Lafferty, that's an easy one. I'd been trying to register to vote for years, and they never let me do it. And when I saw those kids walking that day, I said, I've had enough, the hell with it. And I joined that demonstration, and when the doors of that jail closed on me, Mr. Lafferty, that was the first day of my life I ever felt totally free. It's that which keeps us going. As I said the other night when we were opening our convention, we had all those movement groups up on stage. I said, hey, if it wasn't for those folks, if it wasn't for the people who are really doing the work, there'd be no point in us existing. We only exist because there is a movement of people who are prepared to fight against all odds. Yeah. If we remember our great victories of the past, if we remember quite simply that history itself is on our side, then our day will surely come. And on behalf of that great day, I thank the Guild for giving substance to that little boy's dreams, and I salute the National Lawyers Guild, and I join you in our next 75 years of struggle. Thank you.
That was Jim Lafferty at the National Lawyers Guild 75th Anniversary Convention.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.